Please rise. Iku iluna.
Ohea oko eko ka aha. Inahe kuliana ibu okea aha. Ho oko kolo kolo ki eki hanahano. Oku moku aina ohoi. Inai mai, imaleo mai, ilohi ia kaleo. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. All persons having any business before this honorable Supreme Court of the State of Hawaii, draw nigh. Give your attention and shall be heard. Inoho ilalo. Please be seated.
Velina, makamoku puni o Oahu I kamoko kona me ia no ka koma alio lanihale. Greetings. On the island of Oahu in the district of Kona, we are gathered here at Ali'i Olanihale. And before I ask the clerk to read, call the case, I would like to congratulate my colleague Justice Vlad Devens on his nomination by the governor as our next Chief Justice. Congratulations, Justice Devens. He is going to make an excellent Chief Justice, and I look forward to working with him to make a smooth transition in this position. So, aloha, kakahiaka, good morning. Today's proceeding is being broadcast live on the Judiciary's YouTube channel. I'd like to welcome our substitute justice in this case, Chief Judge Wendy DeWeese from the Third Circuit. Welcome. Thank you for being here. And counsel, are you ready to proceed?
Yes.
All right. The court has allowed 30 minutes for each side. And just to confirm, Mr. Kiyuchi, I understand you plan to argue for 20 minutes and reserve your remaining time for rebuttal. And Mr. Prather, you will have 30 minutes with a 2-minute warning. Mr. Kiyuchi, please proceed.
Thank you.
Good morning, Chief Justice McKenna, Justice of the Supreme Court. Matthew Ishida and I represent the petitioners, who are Bonnie and Jack Swing. This application raises whether a foreclosing lender who did not have standing to foreclose when the complaint was first filed in 2014 can simply amend the complaint to change the date on which the lender must prove it possessed a note to prove standing. This was a case that was before the ICA in 2017. It was reversed by the ICA because the lender could not prove that they had possession of the note when the complaint was 2014. So when it was, the ICA specifically said in their decision, in sum, there's no evidence in the record to establish U.S. Bank's entitlement to enforce the note when it commenced this action. So when it went back on remand, the lender filed a motion to amend the complaint and proceeded to file summary judgment on that amended complaint, arguing that the amendment of the complaint changed the possession date of the note. Despite the fact that when the lender filed that motion to amend the complaint, the lender stated a completely different reason for amending the complaint, did not cite the reason of changing the possession date of the note. As argued in my application, this court should follow the standing at inception rule. And I've cited way back to several cases going back to the Mariana and BR Company case out of Florida in 1911, the Hovey v. Sebring case, which is more relevant because it's actually a foreclosure, a mortgage note case out of Michigan in 1872. The Florida jurisdiction is notable because all of the cases all of Florida says you have to have standing at the inception of a mortgage foreclosure action. And I would stress there's a tremendous difference between a mortgage foreclosure action and simply an action to collect the debt. So those cases have been cited in my application, Corrigan, Russell, Kiefer, Venture Holdings, Matthews. All of those cases stand for the proposition that there needs to be standing at inception.
Mr. Kiyuchi, across the country, I think there's sort of a split of decisions in terms of whether lack of standing at the initiation of the foreclosure action can be corrected by filing an amended complaint subsequently. Would that, is that your view of it?
No, I think there's certainly jurisdictions that take the other view,
right.
But there are more states. I mean, New Jersey is one. In the Dolan v. Darnell case, which is a 1935 case, Schwarzwald out of Ohio, which is a 2012 case. Ohio's also got the Bank of New York Mellon v. Grund. There are cases, I think, throughout the country that say that you have to have standing and exception. Just correcting it later on doesn't give you standing.
In Hawaii, the key or prominent case that required standing and the holding of the note at the time of initiating the foreclosure action was Reyes-Toledo, of course.
Right.
In Reyes-Toledo, I think it was footnote 12, specifically recognized the existence of the Porter case, which in which, you know, addressing the lack of standing at the initiating time period could be addressed by an amended complaint. How do you address that? And this court left Porter in place.
This court did leave Porter in place. What you're referring to is footnote 12 in Reyes-Toledo. However, and I'll get back to Porter, but however, this court in Reyes-Toledo specifically wrote that the requirement that a foreclosing plaintiff prove its entitlement to enforce the note at the commencement of proceedings provides strong and necessary incentives to help ensure that a note holder will not proceed with a foreclosure action before confirming that it has a right to do so. So even if it referred to Porter, Hanalei BRCV Porter in footnote 12, this court reinforced the idea that there has to be standing and exception.
But this court also referred to Porter in addressing some of those reasons why you should have standing at the time of initiating the complaint.
Right.
So, I mean, Porter recognized both aspects as well.
Well, Porter is a very unusual case because in Porter, initially the complaint was filed as a foreclosure complaint and it was on a second mortgage and not the first mortgage. And then the first mortgage foreclosed. But at the time that the that Hanalei BRC filed their complaint, they did not have possession of the note. If you look at the decision, the ICA decision in that case, that was because there was a situation where Hanalei BRC actually was dissolved and a receiver was appointed.
Right.
So what happened in Porter is after they moved to amend the complaint, and it was kind of strange. They moved to amend the complaint after the defendant, Porter, moved for summary judgment. In response to that, the plaintiff said, hey, we want to amend the complaint. But at that point in time, the foreclosure was gone. There was no mortgage foreclosure. And I think what differentiates this case from that case, and if you look at other cases throughout the nation, it's a different situation when you have foreclosure of a mortgage.
Also, would you have the same concerns if amendment is allowed, but it just doesn't relate back to the original filing date? Would you have the same concerns?
No, because I think that it's wrong for the lender to amend the complaint to change the possession date of the note, because what you're allowing a lender to do is simply play with the possession date. And that's why I have less of a concern if the amendment is simply for another reason and not to change the possession date of the note. And in this case, for example, you got a situation where clearly the lender could not prove back in 2014 with that Carrie Jo Dunham declaration that they had possession of the note. And when you have a situation like that, I don't think it's right to allow the lender to amend, to change the possession date.
Yeah.
You know, I don't see how the lender can play with the possession date of the note, and I think that would be my primary concern.
Go ahead.
Go ahead. No.
What would be the real life implications of that in terms of, say, I suppose statute of limitations is an issue that comes up in my mind, and in terms of what the lender, under your view, if it doesn't relate back to the initial filing of the complaint, what would be the effect on the substance of the action?
Well, what a lenders, what a lot of lenders have done, for example, the arguments of the amendment changing the possession note, date of the note, have mainly been raised in Maui because the Swink case is out of Maui. The St. John case, which I mentioned, is tied into that, is out of Maui. The Ryokta case out of Kauai, which this court has accepted writ of cert on, and the Thede case out of Kauai. So both Thede and St. John are still with the ICA. The First Circuit hasn't done that. And a large reason for that is because when Judge Castagnetti had this issue before her, and it was a case involving a borrow named Mallory Longboy, she shut it down. And she shut down, she distinguished Hanalei BRCV Porter from the present situation. So what lenders have been doing in Honolulu, in this circuit, and to a lesser degree on the Big Island, is they've been dismissing the complaint and refiling a new complaint. And what was raised in the opposition to the cert is that there's a question of judicial economy, that because the borrower didn't pay on the note. My argument to that, and anybody who knows me, is I'm not simply not going to give up when you dismiss a complaint and refile it. There are other defenses that can be raised.
So like what? That's my question. What are the substantive impacts of requiring, either requiring a refiling, or if you allow an amended complaint but don't allow it to relate back?
The one defense that comes to mind, which this jurisdiction has not yet recognized, but is recognized in a lot of jurisdictions, is deacceleration of the note. In a lot of situations where you have a case dismissed and a case refiled, the holdings across the country, and I can cite the main case is out of Vermont Supreme Court, Senmar FSB for Malifant. There's the Engel case out of New York. There's the Bartram case out of Florida. All of those cases talk about if you dismiss the complaint and refile, you have to deaccelerate the note. And while that's not before this court, you know, my argument in some circuit court cases has been that deacceleration of the note is a significant impact. It's a significant impact on the borrower because deacceleration puts the borrower back to where it was before the default in the note.
So there would need to be another round of notice, required notices of default, as well as an ability of the borrower to make good at that point?
Yes. It's almost like a reset. And what a lot of these borrowers, a reset would make a tremendous difference to them. And I would argue, and again, while this is not before this court, you ask the question and, you know, I'm trying to directly answer it, but that's going to be raised at some point. I've raised it in pleadings before some of the various circuit courts, and that is an issue that's been raised across the country.
Is there a different requirement? You tried to distinguish the Porter case because at the point in time that the amendment was made, it was pursuant to just the promissory note and not foreclosure. Is there a difference in terms of that type of situation, in terms of requiring, you know, acceleration or deacceleration as you're arguing it?
Yeah, I think the difference, and you can see it, for example, in the Florida courts especially. The Florida courts have pointed out the difference between simply filing an action on the note and filing the foreclosure. One of the cases I didn't cite it in the writ application, I cited in opening brief, is the McLean case. The McLean case specifically talks about one of the problems you have with enforcing the note. A lot of the, you never have a situation where you have the original payee on the note enforcing the note or foreclosing on the mortgage. Most of the time what you have is you have endorsements that go through, but the endorsements never have a date. And one of the things that was pointed out in McLean, because you don't have a date on the endorsement, they require the lender to show that at the time they filed the complaint, that they actually had standing. And one of the ways to do that was proving possession of the note, because the UCC allows someone in possession of the note to enforce the note. So the Florida courts, and I've told people this, I mean, our adjudication of foreclosure cases really kind of really starts with Reyes Toledo. When you look at the Florida cases, they really go back to like the 1960s. So you've got cases like the some of the ones I mentioned in the McLean case, I think, for the issue of standing at inception is probably the most relevant case. But I think the way that other jurisdictions, Florida's a good example, I think New York's another example, and certainly Ohio, I think the Schwarzwald case in Ohio and the cases after that have shown a development. But I think there's a tremendous difference between simply enforcing a note as opposed to enforcing a mortgage.
Question, Mr. Kiyuchi.
Yes.
You know, you mentioned these other jurisdictions and how they treat the standing issue. Do you know whether or not those jurisdictions treat standing as a jurisdictional issue or a prudential issue?
I think they most of them treat it as a prudential issue, and that kind of goes to, you know, what was discussed in Tax Foundation. It's really not jurisdictional, and I think that the federal courts have obviously treated it differently for different reasons, but most of those jurisdictions do treat it as a prudential issue.
And standing is basically a prudential consideration, and it's kind of still based on a constitutional considerations of prudence,
that,
right?
That is correct.
Do you think Reyes-Toledo was actually a new rule of constitutional interpretation?
No, I think Reyes-Toledo took... Reyes-Toledo was very detailed in taking all of the cases that this court had found throughout the nation, incorporating in there. You know, that case was very detailed in what they cited and what was going on in other jurisdictions, and citing that as a basis for the requirement of possession of the note in Reyes-Toledo. I think a lot of the problem I have with a lot of the lenders is they say, well, we didn't know if Reyes-Toledo was coming along. But if you look at Reyes-Toledo carefully, you see the cases that are cited. Those are not recent cases. Those are not like 2017 cases. They're cases that are 15, 20 years old. So the concept of possession of the note to prove standing has gone back a long ways. And as I've said, I think the McLean case makes a very persuasive argument for that, primarily because you have so many situations. I have never seen a situation where the endorsement on the note is dated. So how do you know that's legitimate? How do you know that wasn't done until later time? But that's just one element of standing. So I would say yes, it's prudential. I don't think it's jurisdictional. I think most of the cases across the country would point that out.
I thought Florida, Jersey, some of the others actually were jurisdictional. But nevertheless, you would agree that we should be considering prudential concerns in the balance here.
Yeah, especially based on Tax Foundation.
And let me ask you this. You know, I look at a case out of Oklahoma, Roessler. What's your take on Roessler? Would you agree with that approach?
No, because, you know, Oklahoma's got the balance where you got Brumbaugh, and Brumbaugh kind of goes a little bit different. Brumbaugh does require standing in inception.
What if, you know, it related back to the original filing? Almost, you know, so you don't have your SOL issue, for example. Would that be acceptable to you?
No, well, in this jurisdiction, the statute of limitations really becomes a non-issue in light of the decisions, you know, in Collins, White, and the decisions in Szymanski. And, you know, the writ of cert on Szymanski was my writ of cert. I understand what the court did. It's 20 years. But that even makes it less of an issue because the statute of limitations is 20 years. You shouldn't come up on that issue. Shouldn't come up on that issue at all.
But that should not be the basis for this court's determination,
no,
right? Because the legislature could always change that statute.
That's correct. That is absolutely correct. That should not be the basis. I think that the basis really is that if a lender proceeds, the lender should be able to show how they're able to proceed at that time and not amend that to change it later on, especially, you know, and again, specifically in a foreclosure case.
You know, I mean, I'm not seeing, or maybe you can correct me, if you actually have any merits defense to this case, do you?
I do, and they were raised with the ICA. It included the default letter, included the trustworthiness of the documents, and if this matter is vacated and remanded, I will raise the acceleration issue.
Could those issues be raised if the case, rather than being dismissed, was whether if the bank was allowed to basically amend the complaint?
So the idea is that the bank amends the complaint, but it relates back to the filing of the note. The trustworthiness argument would still apply. I still think the acceleration would apply, and I would still make that argument. I think that the mailing of the default letter is a little bit less of an issue. And the issue raised on mailing of a default letter is you've got a dismissal, then you got a refiling, then the default letter should change.
I mean, hasn't that sort of been sort of criticism of the Florida approach, that it just sort of opened up this almost this cottage industry of litigating, you know, acceleration, litigating, you know, all these other, you know, issues, and hasn't that approach really in the modern era? Because you've cited some 1872 cases and 1960 cases. Now in this era of securitization, it seems like it's a different world, and that simply by dismissing a case, you're really just opening up just a whole, for lack of a better word, can of worms, and we have judicial economy issues. And all that. What's your position?
I can see it in a jurisdiction where you've got a shorter statute of limitations, and Justice McKenna is absolutely correct that the legislature could change that at any time. I don't think that that's really valid. I think that, you know, in Florida, yes, you've had a lot of these arguments, but Florida law continues to evolve as well. So Florida law has been moving. Now,
Has it been moving in the sense that there was some pretty, compelling, let's say, concurrences in many, for example, in the full concurrence and in a couple of the other cases. I don't see where the Florida Supreme Court has actually weighed in. I don't know why, but, you know, well, I mean, there seems to be debate on both sides on the proper approach.
Yeah, I mean, the Florida Supreme Court, for whatever reason, has not weighed in on a lot of these cases. If you look at most of the cases out of Florida, they're all lower court appellate cases. Bartram may be the one exception where they tried to go to the Supreme Court and they had that decided. I don't know why that is. I think, unlike Mr. Dubin, I haven't contacted the other foreclosure attorneys throughout the country.
Well, so it's probably because Florida court just likes to go on vacation and doesn't like to decide things based on their constitution and what they take on cases. But
yeah,
I would think in Florida, which is probably the epicenter of foreclosures, they would have wanted to weigh in. But, I mean, are we just talking about form over substance here, Mr. Kiyuchi?
No, I don't think so. I think that this is part of requiring a showing by the lender that they have standing at the inception of the note. Don't put a homeowner through, and a homeowner that goes through foreclosure, that's a pretty traumatic experience. Don't put a homeowner through foreclosure unless you have standing. And this court's decision in Reyes Toledo kind of emphasize that.
But isn't it sort of the bottom line that, you know, you just, as long as the banks or the lender, you know, has possession of the note, you know, whether a case is dismissed or whether there's a leave to amend, the possession of the note, once it really, I mean, isn't that the key? And that's what Reyes Toledo was really saying.
I don't see any weakening of Reyes Toledo by allowing amendment, in other words.
Well, I think that the problem is, should a lender be allowed to really manipulate the possession data to know? And in this case, they couldn't prove it in 2014. So they, should they be allowed to change it? And in that sense, I would say...
Are you suggesting fraud in the amended, the new declaration? Are you suggesting that they did not possess the note at the
in
time
2014?
At their time of the original complaint?
In 2014, you've got the Carrie Jo Dunham declaration that says that she saw the note. But the problem really with the 2014 declaration was that wasn't the same entity. And you have this situation where you have lenders throughout the country that put the notes in vaults, and there's no connection between where the note is and who has jurisdiction over that and who filed the complaint. You know, that's a little bit different situation. That's what you have, which is much more common. So with that, I would like to reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal. Thank you.
May it please the court, I'd like to thank the court for taking the time to take this case on. It's very important, as we discussed in 2017, I think the Reyes Toledo case significantly changed the judicial foreclosure landscape. I think even in the transcript of the hearing from the motion for summary judgment in this case, opposing counsel admits for the first time in Reyes Toledo, this court established that the foreclosing mortgagee needs to establish entitlement to enforce as of the date the complaint was initiated. We cited multiple cases in our response that made it clear that leading up to that, it was pretty much the standard practice that you would establish entitlement to enforce as of the date the motion for summary judgment was filed. So we have this whole population of cases, some filed 10, 12 years prior to Reyes Toledo, who are now faced with, okay, how do we prove possession as of the date the complaint was filed? And that's really where the issue comes in. Because, in this case, like opposing counsel stated, we do have the certification that came along, with the first motion for summary judgment stating that in June 9th, a representative of Wells Fargo, who is respondent's loan servicer in this case, and the respondent's been the same throughout. In this case, the same entity that's on the pleadings today is the entity that was on the pleadings in 2014, but its servicer at that time was Wells Fargo, and the representative stated that I personally reviewed the note on June 9th of 2014, and it was the original. But the complaint isn't filed until December, 6 months later. So, and the note possession certification isn't dated. But what is consistent is there's a copy of the note attached to the complaint. It contains the same special endorsement to Wells Fargo Bank NA, and it contains the same endorsement in blank by Wells Fargo Bank NA. So we have the same copy attached to the certification back from June 9th. We have the same copy attached to the complaint. We have the same copy of the note attached to the declaration of indebtedness that's filed along with the motion for summary judgment, the first one back in 2017. And we have the same copy of the note that's filed along with the second motion for summary judgment, which led to the foreclosure judgment, which is before this court today. So it's been consistent throughout the plaintiff's position, the respondent's position regarding possession, that the respondent is in possession or was in possession when the original complaint was filed. The issue is, how do we prove it? So, going back to 2014, we have the note certification declaration based on personal knowledge. And that's, like I said, 6 months prior to the complaint being filed. And what this court set forth in Verhagen and also in the Yata case is you can establish possession over a period of time encompassing the complaint. And the longer that span of time is, the more you open yourself to a challenge, but you are allowed to basically establish possession as long as it includes the date the complaint was filed. So if the respondent in this case is not allowed to establish standing as of the date the amended complaint is filed, that means they have to go back and they have to find someone or some way to establish possession from June of 2014 until some date after the complaints filed in December of 2014, or even on the date. And I think it's highly unlikely that they're going to be able to find someone who has personal knowledge. So without that, the foreclosing mortgagee is forced to rely on business records. And, you know, going back to 2014 and getting business records, providing the sufficient foundational testimony for the admission of those business records and establishing possession is going to be difficult. And even if they were to go back and do that, how do they know that's going to be sufficient for the court? And I, you know, discussed the Yata case briefly earlier, and that's this court's decision with kind of a similar situation where the foreclosing mortgagee files a foreclosure complaint in 2014. In 2018, they move for summary judgment. And in support of their motion for summary judgment, they provide a screenshot that shows possession of the original note from 2013 to 2015. So that's a period of time that includes the date the original complaint was filed, as is, you know, allowed under Verhagen. They prevail at the trial court level, they prevail at the ICA level, and then the case comes before this court, and this court says the screenshot's insufficient because there's no evidence as to where the screenshot came from or how the screenshot can be interpreted. So even with documentary evidence, it's entirely possible that you could have this case go on another 6 to 8 years and have it come up before this court or maybe another appellate court and say, well, the documented evidence isn't sufficient, and now you're back to square one. You know, there's also a more recent case from the ICA, Deutsche Bank versus Maher, again, where the court looked at a screenshot that was intended to establish possession and found that it was insufficient. So that's really the risk,
I think. What's the impact of that? If you've got to then, if you're not able to prove possession in 2014, the impact is refiling a new complaint, assuming there's still default, and the impact is what? I'd like to hear your thoughts on that.
Well, the big impact is the debt. So the debt continues to accrue, all right? And the interest continues to accrue. If you're looking at this case, the per diem interest alone is $129. So that means in the time, that since the time the judgment has been issued up until today, we're talking about an additional $200,000 in interest alone that's continued to accrue. So the impact on the borrower of going back and restarting is the additional debt. There's also the issue of additional fees and costs. And what the reality is under Section 6E of the note and Section 9 of the mortgage, any money the lender expends to recover under the note and mortgage is recoverable against the borrower. So that
if I'm understanding your argument, then is that it's actually detrimental to the debtor,
yes,
by requiring a refiling of the amended of a new complaint,
yes,
because then the debt certainly has increased by that point, assuming the payments have been made, there's foreclosure action is pending, but all the penalties and interest have been accruing in the meantime.
That's correct.
Well, that's pretty gracious of you to protect the borrower there, bank lender. But, you know, let me ask you this. I mean, it seems like you're trying to make Reyes-Toledo pretty toothless, that Reyes-Toledo is just aspirational. It's just optional. I mean, isn't that ultimately where your position leads?
No, I don't think so, because I think in the cases after Reyes-Toledo, and yeah, there's strict compliance with it. I know for a fact our office, you know, since Reyes-Toledo has been issued, we don't start a foreclosure action until we have the original note in our hand. So I don't think it's toothless. I just think there's, a population of cases that existed prior to that where lenders are going to be forced to go back and try to find some sort of proof. And in doing that, you know, the meter continues to run. And, you know, I agree with the concept of protecting the borrower. I don't have anything against that. I think it's important. But I also think like the concept of protection needs to be looked at in sort of a broader lens. And are you really doing...
Well, why do you think the borrowers aren't really using that as an example to support their position?
I'm sorry, an example of what?
Why aren't the borrowers using your position? Hey, we could be saving $200,000 if we took your position. Why wouldn't the borrowers be saying that?
Because I think from my position, the idea of defending a foreclosure action is to drag it out. And so I think that's why no one's interested in saving the money. They'd rather stretch it out and maintain possession of the property. So
have there been issues in Florida with standing by inception?
Yeah, I think it's
been. Can you detail what they might have been?
Well, I think some of the cases that are relied on have to do with cases where there's a lost note, and then subsequently the note has been discovered. And in those cases, you know, they said it's basically, I think, a different theory of recovery. So yeah, you can't just amend and proceed. But that's not the case here. Like, it's been consistent, like I said, that the plaintiff has been in possession of the original note endorsed in blank since the outset. The issue is, can that be proven to the court's satisfaction? And I think that's the problem. You know, we have the undated note certification, saying possession 6 months prior. But, you know, are we going to be able to go back and get proof that, like I said, you know, is sufficient for the court to establish possession? Because there's an entirely wide array of interpretation, I can tell you, throughout the circuits in the state as to what is sufficient to prove possession. So while a screenshot may be sufficient in one particular trial court, it may not be sufficient when the issue goes up on appeal. That's why we relied on the Hanalei Bay versus Porter case.
Let me ask you this, as far as reliance, because I do note in your briefing, you do rely on the Roessler case from Oklahoma, where it's sent back and it's motion to leave to amend and the original complaints, you know, dismissed. What's your take on that approach?
I think that's fine. I think the idea under the Beneficial of Hawaii case is that the original complaint or the amended complaint supersedes the original. Yeah, I don't think we're going to run into statute of limitations issues, particularly in this case, not with the 20-year statute. This isn't a case where we're seeking personal liability, where we're strictly seeking to foreclose on the mortgage. So I don't think there's an issue. I think, there's discussion of Rule 15C, which I think has to do with remedying any statute of limitations issues, but there's no Rule 15C.
Would that be remedied if it relates back to the original complaint, the statute of limitation? Would you have an issue with that?
Not in this case. No, I don't think.
But only because we have a 20-year limitation?
That's right. We do have a 20-year statute of limitation. I mean, it's 6 under 657-1 for personal liability on the note, but pursuant to 657-31, we get 20 years. You know, we're allowed 20 years to foreclose in this jurisdiction. So typically there aren't foreclosure or statute of limitation issues with foreclosures. I mean, in the years to come, there will be, even with the 20-year.
What's your position on Mr. Cucci's acceleration and deacceleration problems with that approach?
I think, you know, we cited three cases. It's mostly in support of our argument that the ICA has allowed cure by amendment in other situations, but those cases were, they also dealt with the breach letter and can you fix the breach letter by amending. It was the STL Holdings case. I believe it was White. And then the third case was Hall. So in those cases, in the STL Holdings case and the White case, they didn't require deceleration to cure after the original complaint was filed when a new breach letter was sent. In Hull, the foreclosing mortgagee took the affirmative step of deceleration and sending a new acceleration letter, but it wasn't required by the court. I also think, like, and this is more of an overall sort of take on it, but, you know, if you look at the terms of the mortgage itself, a borrower is allowed to reinstate at any time up until a judicial foreclosure order is entered. So I think there's sort of a bigger legal question as to whether or not a loan can actually be accelerated at all. But just for the purposes of this case, I think there's precedent, you know, from the ICA saying that deceleration is not required. But much is being made of these distinctions in the Porter case, at least by the petitioners, and I don't think there's really that big of a difference. The fact that they started out with a foreclosure claim and then they abandoned it and they pursued an action under the note, I don't think changes the law. It's still an action on the note, and I think the same reasoning should be applied. And that has mostly to do with sort of the overall judicial economy. Well, let me go back for 1 second, because we're talking about how this court addressed Porter and the Reyes-Toledo decision. So in two separate ways, it addressed, you know, in footnote 12, I believe, as we discussed earlier, whether or not Porter gives you the right to amend, and, you know, kind of left the issue alone. But one of the other issues it addressed with regard to Porter is the idea of standing at inception protects a maker from multiple liabilities on the same note. And this is brought up a lot, and to me, I refer to this argument as Bigfoot. I've heard a lot about it. I've never seen it happen. I've never seen a borrower sued twice at the same time on the same debt. I've been doing it for 17 years now. I haven't seen it happen. So I understand the idea is to protect the borrower from that instance. But I don't think that really occurs. I mean, if you look at this particular case, you know, the borrowers defaulted in 2009, or their last payment was in 2009. The breach letter gave them up until, I believe, May of 2014 to cure. And this case has been going on for 12 years. So you would think if another lender was going to bring an action on the same debt, it would have happened by now, and it hasn't.
Mr. Porter, one of the things that I always wonder about on foreclosure actions is why does it take so long? You know, I mean, you just said default in 2009, the complaint wasn't filed until 2014. The bank didn't move for SJ until 2 years later, or maybe a year and a half. But, you know, one of the things you're arguing to us is it's so hard to go back in time, find the evidence to establish what is needed under now Verhagen and Yata, before it was Berendt and a variety of other cases. But why does it take so long?
There could be a number of reasons. Post-default, a borrower could be engaged in loss mitigation efforts with the lender. They could be trying to work something out.
Modifying the loan, mm-hmm. et cetera.
Yeah, exactly. There could be bankruptcies that may be filed by the borrower that would prevent the lender from moving forward. There could be military service issues.
But in the meantime, if a bank knows that there is a default, I mean, and the idea that litigation is a potential, obtaining the evidence necessary to initiate a foreclosure action certainly should be on the mind of a bank, shouldn't it?
I completely agree, and I think post 2017 it is. That's why I started off by saying I think it was a huge change. I mean, I know for a fact I went in for a motion for summary judgment hearings on a Wednesday with Judge Castagnetti, like everyone else does, 2 days after that decision was issued, with my typical huge stack of motions for summary judgment, and we just continued every one because, that changed things. The Reyes-Toledo decision changed things, and it may be the court's position that it really. The lenders should have known based on the statute. They should have anticipated something like that, but it wasn't the practice. It was the practice to establish possession and entitlement to enforce as of the motion for summary judgment. So,
I think there actually was an ICA case, a published opinion, where establishing possession of the note at SJ was affirmed. So,
yes.
I think the case law, in my view, has sort of changed over time. And certainly that was an ICA decision, not a Supreme Court decision. So, certainly that's a relevant point, I suppose. But yeah, I guess I would just say, the issues about gathering evidence and all of that, I mean, that area of the law has sort of been litigated extensively as well. I guess I just want to, while I have the opportunity, is to say, it just is quite unusual in my mind why it would take so long. I recognize why there are differences in every situation, but marshaling the evidence, certainly now that we are in 2026, it shouldn't be an issue going forward.
No, I understand. And I understand there's a lot of judicial dissatisfaction with the pace with which the foreclosure cases move. Part of the issue is, that the goal moves a little, with changes in the law. So we have to deal with issues like, prior business records. Mm-hmm. Do we have sufficient foundational testimony for the admission of prior business records? For a while, even though I thought it was clear under Verhagen that the testifying witness just needed to establish their familiarity with the receiving entity's record keeping system. the way that case was interpreted is certain judges were requiring us to provide declarations from each prior servicer or an entity that worked with the current servicer that worked with each prior one. So you'd have to find someone at NationStar that just happened to work at Bank of America and also worked at Wells Fargo and could testify.
Well, Reyes-Toledo also, though, that it reflects the situation in the market, right? The fact that mortgages were securitized and, you know, traded as commodities or whatever, that's part of the problem that Reyes-Toledo recognized and why those rulings were made in terms of the requirement of establishing standing.
Sure. And here's what I'd say about securitization. That issue's basically been litigated out of the foreclosure equation. There's multiple ICA decisions at this point that say, you know, whether or not the foreclosing mortgagee confirmed or complied with the terms of a trust, whether or not the loan was transferred in, transferred out before the trust was open, before it was closed, that stuff no longer matters because, in a big part, the borrower is not a party to those documents. And it really, what it comes down to is note possession. And the issue is, you know, were you entitled to enforce? And that also has to do with the arguments as they go to the assignment of mortgage. You know, there's a lot of arguments about, well, was the entity in bankruptcy when they assigned the mortgage? And the reality is now, and I think this court made clear in Reyes-Toledo, and it's been upheld subsequently, is that the mortgage follows the note. And so if there's issues about the assignments, whatever the case may be, it really doesn't matter as long as you can establish possession. And just, you know, getting back to the concept.
Excuse me. Do you think, let me ask you what I asked Mr. Kiyuchi, do you think that Reyes-Toledo was actually a new rule of constitutional interpretation and that cases pre-Reyes-Toledo should be treated differently from cases post-Reyes-Toledo?
I don't know if it was or not. I just know what the practice was prior to that. And I know the practice was you established as of summary judgment. And, you know, whether or not that's a constitutional change, you know, I can't really answer it. I don't think so. But I just know that that's how cases were handled prior to that date. So, you know, it definitely changed the law. I think the standing as far as, you know, is it jurisdictional, is it a just disability issue, I think that's the same. But I think what happened is it just changed sort of the practice as far as foreclosure cases were handled. And then, you know, the issue, again, regarding...
Before you get into that, I want to circle back to a comment you made about post-Verhaeghe anonymous superproof. Have any of those cases been appealed? To your knowledge, have any of those post-Verhaeghe, what I think I heard you say is some of this extra proof stance by some judges, are you aware of any of those cases on appeal?
No, because I don't think lenders typically don't take appeals.
Oh, okay, but I mean, as an issue of cross appeal or anything of that nature?
No, but I think there's been, you know, some development in that area just through ICA opinions, just based on appeals brought by borrowers. So, for instance, I think there's a recent ICA decision that just said, you know, if you have prior servicers, say you had your current servicer is NewRez, prior to that it was Wells Fargo, prior to that it was Bank of America. When you file your declaration, you just have to name the servicer immediately prior to the current one. You don't have to name all the prior ones. So I think that issue is getting honed down slowly, but I'm not a...
Okay, I understand. You can go to your other point.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. The other issue I was going to bring up is, you know, and getting back to the idea of protection of the borrower, there's still the affirmation requirement, you know, and there were two separate affirmation requirements filed in this case. There's one with the original complaint and one with the second complaint. And both of them, you know, both of them say that a representative of the plaintiff reviewed the allegations and the documents and confirmed their veracity. So, you know, this goes back to kind of the idea of are we leaving borrowers open to be sued multiple times on the same note? And I just think that's an extra level of protection. And, you know, there was a little bit of discussion during the earlier argument about judicial economy. And I think that's why we relied on the Miguel case. And the situation's a little different in that case. It has to do with, well, the foreclosing mortgagee wasn't assigned the mortgage until 2 months after the action was initiated and was still given judgment. These days, it wouldn't really matter if they had the note, whether or not they were assigned the mortgage. But the ICA looked at that and said, well, you know, we could make them go back and start all over, but what's the point? You know, we're going to use up additional judicial resources, and the parties are just going to end up in the exact same position that they're in. And I think the question was posed earlier, well, if the foreclosing mortgagee was forced to dismiss and restart his case, what would you do differently? And I think the issues raised were, well, the trustworthiness of the documents and the breach letter. I mean, those issues were already raised in the last motion for summary judgment. So, yeah, I think the point of Miguel is, okay, we could start over. What's going to be different? And there really, I don't think there's been a showing as to what would be different. We just, like I said, we'd incur additional fees. There'd be interest. There'd be filing fees. There'd be service fees. That's all going to add to the debt. And where that comes into play is, you know, in this case, maybe the idea is, well, you're not seeking a deficiency judgment against the borrower, so why should the borrower care? But where it comes into play is when it gets down to the bid. So if the foreclosing mortgagee obtains a foreclosure judgment, the property goes to auction, and the foreclosing mortgagee can bid up to the amount it's owed in the judgment with additional amounts that accrue thereafter. So if you have a property with equity and you have a third party bidder that wants to come in and bid way beyond what all the other lienors are owed, then it's entirely possible that you're going to end up with excess proceeds. And those excess proceeds could in fact end up with the borrower, help the borrower get on with their life, start new. But if the judgment or the amount owed to the lender just keeps growing, it eats into that. And I think eventually, you know, it's going to swallow up the entire bid. So that's another issue. And I think, you know, that the Miguel case did a great job addressing it. And then, you know, it doesn't only impact borrowers, but I think it also impacts, like, for instance, neighboring homeowners. So, you know, a lot of calls our office will get will be like, hey, there's an abandoned property next to me. What's taking you guys so long to foreclose on it? And we have to explain to them, well, we thought we were there. We thought we were going to get judgment, and then the goal shifted a little. And now we have to go back, and we have to start all over again. You know, or maybe there's the issue of a community association. And we're, you know, if we're foreclosing on an owner in a community association, the odds are the owner is not paying their maintenance fees either, which means that the other owners in the association have to carry the burden of the non-paying owner. And so when those cases stretch out, we get the same call saying, hey, why is this taking so long? And we have to explain again, well, you know, we thought we had it, but, you know, things have changed. And so if we're forced to go back and restart, or if this court requires foreclosing mortgagees to go back and restart, you know, because they can't prove standing as of the date of the amended complaint, it really draws the process out. And, you know, there's no question that there's a default in this case. I think there was one declaration from Bonnie Swink in this case, and it was submitted in opposition to the first motion for summary judgment. And she's pretty clear that they went into default because there were some issues with their business. There's some additional stuff in there about trying to obtain a loan modification, but by and large, there's no contest as to the default in this case. You know, there's $1.5 million owed as of early 2022, according to the foreclosure judgment. So I don't know that by forcing my client to go back and restart the whole process, the borrowers in this case are really being protected. I think it's pretty cut and dry in this case. And there's also the issue of the, you know, the burden on the lender in this case. You know, we established in the motion for summary judgment that my clients paid over $40,000 in property taxes and another $97,000 for insurance premiums. So there's, I mean, that issue as well. And then lastly, I would just say, you know, not necessarily the borrowers in this case, but there are borrowers who will call us and they'll say, you know, maybe they're a unit owner and they say, I defaulted 10 years ago. I moved out of the property. The association at that point has probably foreclosed themselves subject to our lien and they've sold the property, whatever the case may be, but the borrower is long gone. And the borrower calls us and said, why is there still a foreclosure action pending? It's killing my credit. I'm constantly served with documents. Why haven't you guys resolved this issue? And so we have to explain to them, sorry, we're trying, But now we have to go all the way back to the beginning. We have to start over. We're going to have to serve you with a new complaint. And you're going to have to, you know, deal with the pleadings, and you're going to have to wait this one out too. So just getting back to the idea of protection, I would just suggest that the idea of protecting the borrower sort of be viewed in a wider lens, especially given the facts of this case and given the impacts it can have on the community overall. And if there are no further questions, I'll wrap up. Thank you.
Any rebuttal, Mr. Yes. Kiyuchi?
I just want to address a couple of points made by Mr. Brather. He said it's hard to prove possession going back, but this is a situation, all of these notes are endorsed in blank. They're endorsed in blank, they become basically bearer paper. So why in the world wouldn't the loan servicers track this thing meticulously? Now, I just did a trial before Judge Jackson in Kona in February, where that was part of the issue, and there was a showing that the note went from point A to point B to point C. So why does it become so hard? You know, he raises the issue in IATA, but in IATA is more than just a screenshot. They never had the loan servicer come forward and say, look, the note went from point A to point B to point C. And a lot of times, what happens with these lenders or servicers is they put the note in a vault. I mean, I've gotten to the point where I can memorize where all the vaults in the country are, in Eagan, Minnesota for Wells Fargo, in Santa Ana for Deutsche Bank, and PHH has one in Florida, and SBS has one in Salt Lake City. So, you know, I've gotten to the point where I basically memorize where they are. That's because that's where they place them. They just don't place them on an office shelf. They have a record, and they should be required to prove where it is. That's not the homeowner's burden. That is the burden of the lender. As far as the debt continuing to accrue and refiling the new complaint, this is post-monolim. So I can tell you there are very few situations. I've had two cases in the state where a fair market value hearing was conducted, and both were situations where the debt was well over $500,000. That is rare. Most of the lenders now don't move. So yes, the debt continues to accrue, but most of the time when that happens, the property goes back to the lender. This is kind of an unusual case because this wasn't the 2014 complaint, wasn't the first complaint. As I noted in the writ of cert, there was a 2009 filing that was subsequently dismissed by the lender. And I guess it goes to Justice Inouye's question, why does it take so long? And I think, frankly, having stepped into this world of representing homeowners after Mr. Dubin was disbarred, I will say, I think it takes too long as well. I mean, I think that resolution should be a lot quicker. With all due respect, the Swinks, Jack Swink, still lives on the property. When the fire occurred in upcountry, Jack Swink was out there with his hose trying to prevent his house from being burned down rather than saying, hey, let it burn down. I think that homeowners truly care about staying in the property. I think if the Swinks had the opportunity, and again, I've mentioned the acceleration. That's not before this court. That's not the issue here. That is an issue that at some point will come up before this court. And the Vermont Supreme Court has a very insightful decision opinion in Senlar FSB versus Malafant. That case gives an idea and kind of weighs out what happens when you have a dismissal and a refiling. And in that case, they dismissed because the statute of limitations was imminent. This is, after all, an equitable proceeding. So I would like nothing better than for the homeowners to have a do-over. That's probably not going to happen, but that's what deacceleration in part does. And the lender, regardless, should be required to prove possession. Again, They have this network of loan servicers, this network of custodians. If you you have a pooling and servicing agreement, you got a loan servicer, you got the actual lender, and you got a custodian. So you've got the little elements there. They can prove it. And the idea that it's hard to prove possession going back, I'm sorry, I'm just not accepting that. So I would ask this court to vacate the ICA opinion, circuit court opinion, and remand this matter back. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, counsel. E ka pauna ka aha ho kolokolo ina mea pili I keia hihia. This court will take this matter under advisement.
E ku iluna, please rise. Ua ho o ku u ia mai ne kea aha ho o kolokolo ki iki hanahano o ka moku aina o Hawaii. This Honorable Supreme Court of the State of Hawaii is now adjourned.